Good evening, everyone. We're so glad that you can be here with us for this Answers in Energy speaker series. We have today with us an absolutely fantastic speaker. His name is Steve Taylor, and Steve is the managing director in Charlotte, North Carolina, for Wells Fargo's securities. So, as you know, the Answers in Energy speaker series is dedicated to addressing issues of energy, natural resources, and environmental law and policy here in the United States and worldwide. Answers in Energy is a part of the University of Tulsa Law School, and particularly our Master of Jurisprudence in Energy program. It is a degree program that's open to lawyers and non-lawyers alike who need specialized education in energy, natural resources, and environmental law to further their goals, their lives, and their careers. The Answer in Energy speaker series is, in fact, part of one of the formal classes for the Master of Jurisprudence in Energy Law, the class we call Thesis Laboratory. And for those of you who are attending the series on this series live, you're actually in our online classroom. I have with me today Rick Munoz. Rick, would you say hi?
Hello. Thank you, Jason. The philosophy behind the class is that this speaker series provides an opportunity for our students to hear about some important issues in energy law on which they'll base their thesis papers. So it's a wonderful opportunity for them to learn and to meet new people via this platform.
And Rick, is, as you can tell, is the professor for Thesis Laboratory. And today, Rick and I together are going to interview Steve as a part of this series. You'll notice the names of others that are here in the classroom with you. And some of these folks are already master degree candidates. Others are University of Tulsa alumni. Some may be interested potential future students that we've invited to come along as our friends. In the upper kind of center portion of your screen, you're going to see a chat box. And if you have any questions, you can type them in there, and then we'll ask those questions to Steve for you towards the end of the program. So with that, if you'd allow me just 1 minute to offer a formal introduction to our distinguished guest, Steve Taylor. As I'd mentioned before, Steve is a managing director and head of the Investment Grade Energy Debt Capital Markets Group at Wells Fargo Securities. He also has substantial responsibility for covering the chemicals industry, and he's based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Steve oversees the origination and execution of investment-grade public and private bond offerings for his clients. He's responsible for building Wells Fargo's market-leading energy debt capital markets platform, which consistently ranks as one of the top of the league tables. Prior to this, Steve had similar responsibilities for the high-yield debt capital markets group. Prior to joining Wells Fargo, Steve was an investment and corporate banker for metals, mining, and industrial clients at the Chemical Bank and at Continental Illinois. Steve received a BS in Business Administration from Georgetown and an MBA from Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Steve, we're absolutely thrilled that you could be here with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Steve, we wanted to talk with you and really begin talking about the energy boom here in the United States. So let's start out broadly. How did the energy boom happen?
Well, we were really in a difficult circumstance only a few years ago, and that was when 5 to 10 years ago, it felt like our energy assets were being depleted. And we were relying more on the Middle East, Canada, Mexico, Venezuela, some of those locations with some not too friendly trading partners. And it was primarily because many of our oil fields were getting depleted and were not really, were basically running out of supply. So our techniques fell behind our production needs. And as we had some breakthroughs in how to extract oil and gas, primarily horizontal drilling, fracking, a better imaging, we discovered that we could take resources from our huge shale assets that were completely ignored and too expensive to extract hydrocarbons from in the past. So with that, we've heard so much about horizontal drilling. We've heard about fracking. We know it's controversial, but it is effective in greatly increasing our oil and gas resources in this country.
Well, where is this increase in resources happening?
It's in quite a few locations, to be honest. Many locations that were never thought of as oil and gas producing areas, such as the Marcellus Shale in New York and Pennsylvania, the Utica Shale covering the whole eastern part of Ohio, the Balkans, Williston Basin in North Dakota, the San Joaquin Valley. There's a huge area called the Monterey Shale in California. So it's really in many new areas of the country, and that requires new infrastructure. We don't have pipelines to North Dakota, as many as we need, given the production up there. We also have tremendous production coming out of the Permian Basin in Texas and the Eagle Ford basins in southern Texas, and certainly all throughout your state in Oklahoma. So those fields are getting new, rather fabulous extensions of life.
Wow. Is there a difference between the development that's occurring in the United States, let me backtrack for a second. I've heard a lot of times that this development in the shale fields is called unconventional development. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
That which you've just described, let's call it unconventional development, is there a difference of what's occurring in the United States with unconventional development versus what's happening in Canada?
Yes. What's happening in the United States is we're going after oil and gas, and with it comes natural gas liquids, and those are the resources that we're seeking to exploit. The Canadian production has some of those, especially in British Columbia, but the real crown jewel for Canada is in northern Alberta in the oil sands, bitumen. And so that is a different resource, and it's a different way to go about extracting oil.
Are those oil sands some of the same oil sands that are kind of tied up in the whole XL pipeline controversy?
Yes, most definitely. Canada, with 25 million people compared to our 325 million people, can't use all the oil that they can produce. And so the Alberta oil sands, the bitumen that is coming out of Alberta is already being shipped to the United States through several pipelines, but production is ramping up because they've had a major investment in those oil sands, and they're just now reaping the benefits of that, and they've got to put it someplace. They can't just keep building tanks for it, and they want to move it along and sell the oil. So they're looking to expand the pipeline capacity, and absolutely, this is part of one of the major pipelines sponsored by TransCanada, the Keystone XL that we've been hearing so much about.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the benefits and the costs and justifications. Let's start really with the benefits. What do you think the benefit is to the United States for the development of all of these unconventional resources?
Well, in 2012, Merrill Lynch, part of Bank of America, did a study, and they found that the daily GDP benefit of just looking at unconventional natural gas and oil was to the country $1 billion per day, or taken over the course of a year, that's 2.2% of total GDP for the entire country. So given that GDP is currently running at 3.7%
growth,
if the unconventional, that's correct, 3.7% growth off of a GDP level of about $16 trillion. If unconventional energy is adding 2.2%, then that would be the majority of the growth that we're seeing in our economy today, and a very significant portion, keeping in mind that when we feel a recession, we're negative 2 or 3%. So this is very important. The other benefit is, obviously, it helps our chemical industries, because the petrochemicals, the hydrocarbons, are building blocks for those chemical industries, ethane, propane, butane, isobutane. And let's not forget about the manufacturing element, the construction element of building new pipelines, new refineries, new storage facilities. It all snowballs into improving the economy, not to mention lower prices for consumers.
Wow. So just to go back for a second, because I didn't realize that the energy boom was having that tremendous of an impact on the growth of our economy. Each year, the growth right now is about 3.7%, and you're saying 2.2% of that is supplied by the energy boom.
Yes, and I'm not saying 2.2% of 3.7. I'm saying 2.2 of the total GDP.
The total GDP.
And this was a study that was done. That's correct. When you look at the numbers, when you look at the how it's impacted the cost of and how it's benefited the production, you can then take it a step further and say, well, doesn't the United States benefit tremendously by having the back payments work in their favor? Because if we buy a barrel of oil and ship that money to the Middle East, we're not only shipping it to potentially an area of the country, area of the world that's unfriendly to us, but we're contributing to the imbalance that we have in trade with most nations of the world, and so the benefit here is exceptional, and we've got a technological advantage on the rest of the world. China has significant shale assets. They're looking to catch up in their technology. Mexico has significant shale assets. So this is technology that will be replicated in other areas that have similar geology.
I have another kind of question related to that. How long do we expect these energy resources to last and fuel this economic growth?
Well, that's a good question. It's been estimated that the natural gas that's discovered, some people have said it's a 100-year supply based upon current usage in the United States. The oil numbers are not that impressive, but we have to look back to 2008. In 2008, we replaced, by finding new oil, only about half of the production that we used in the year 2008. Last year, we replaced 2.5 times the amount of oil that we use in a single year. So it's not as an impressive life of an oil reserve as it is in natural gas, but it is very important to think that we're replacing our oil reserves faster than we can use them. And when you consider how large a user the United States is, we use 18,000 barrels of oil a day. And to put that in perspective, the whole continent of Europe uses 14,400 barrels of oil a day. So if we can replace our oil 2.5 times greater than we're using it, and we're the largest user of oil in the world, then that's saying something. That's a huge find.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this oil isn't just, you know, leaping out of the ground and driving itself down to the refinery to get fixed up into gasoline. How does that take place, and what kind of costs are associated with that?
The amount of infrastructure is tremendous. The numbers that I have in front of me suggest that in exploration and production companies alone, the 50 largest, when you look at their spending in the United States alone, was for the year 2012 $185 billion. Looking at the midstream part of the energy industry, which midstream refers to basically pipelines, that's another $120 billion of spending that took place in 2012. The numbers for 2013 aren't in yet, but they're expected to be larger. And as we talk to companies about their financing needs in 2014 and beyond, their budgets keep going up. So the amount of spending to exploit this resource that we have is really tremendous. It's fairly conservatively estimated to be $300 billion a year in the United States.
That's an enormous amount of money.
And one other, it's an enormous amount of money, but put it in perspective this way also. Wasn't President Obama's stimulus plan a number of years ago about $850 billion?
Yeah. Yeah, to
I think it was. I think it was in that neighborhood. So when you think about the energy industry alone spending $300 billion a year for years to come and for years in the past, this is a stimulus plan that benefits the country.
Wow. Let's go ahead. You had a question, Rick?
yes, Steve. This is Rick. I would like to follow up with the question in regards to the papers that the students are writing, and I appreciate your information in regards to the impact, the financial impact of unconventional resources are on U.S. economic growth. That's a profound information you've shared with our, us. And I'd like to ask you, in terms of given the importance of it, from a legal perspective, what are some of the legal issues that you've come across in your work in regards to financing that have fostered development of these unconventional resources, and also any legal issues that you've come across through your work that have hampered access to these unconventional resources?
Well, I'll deal with the hampering one first, because that's the most obvious, and that is decisions like Keystone XL, which is a pipeline tied to unconventional resources in Canada, is being treated as a political or an environmental decision. Now, you could say, if you were wise, that Canada will produce their oil sands whether we use them or not. They'll build pipelines to the West Coast and ship them to Asia. They'll build pipelines to the East Coast of Canada and ship them to Europe if we don't choose to purchase their oil. So certainly the legal issues affecting that pipeline. And just yesterday, a judge in Nebraska ruled that the governor of Nebraska didn't have the authority to approve the pipeline through the state, that it was the Public Utility Commission, I believe, or Energy Commission, that had that authority. So he overruled the governor yesterday. So that legal fight will continue. On the legal and regulatory side, what doesn't get talked about a lot is that there are numerous permits getting approved for drilling. And those drilling permits are oftentimes granted for drilling on government-owned land. And so in those circumstances, the government is very helpful in helping to continue to expand the energy resources that we have in this country. So from a legal perspective, you can't talk about energy and the extraction and transportation of energy without getting into environmental and safety matters, where the government and law are well defined and very very protective of the citizens, as the companies are. When we look back on the BP scenario of their leak in the Gulf of Mexico, obviously BP would never hope to repeat anything like that again, because as far as I have read, that the cost of that spill is comfortably over $25 billion and continues to rise. So the companies themselves suffer greatly financially when there's a mishap or an environmental problem, and of course all those citizens in those areas can suffer as well.
Okay, thank you, Steve. I think that was a nice depiction of several important issues that I think that students could focus on for a thesis paper, and a couple of them to recap them. I think, obviously, the environmental issue is a broad one, but I think a couple of interesting ones that Steve mentioned that you might think about is the role of states and their authority in regards to an issue of, like, the Keystone Pipeline. I think that would be a very well, I know it's a very novel issue, obviously. That's why the judge from Nebraska ruled the way she did yesterday. It's because there's a lot of debate over the role of states in that. So I think that would be something that would be very apropos to do a thesis on. And also the permitting process that he mentioned as well would be something that I think there's a lot of rich information and debate over the best approach in regards to permitting.
Yeah. Well, so
I will also add one other thought there too, is when I mentioned the pipelines that Canada could build to the East Coast to Europe, which obviously from a geographic perspective are quite far, to get to the Atlantic. They said that pipeline would be easier to build across the Great Plains, across the farm ranch land, than it would be to build the shorter pipeline from Alberta to the West Coast to the Pacific. And I quizzed them why. How could that be possible? And they said that there were numerous Indian tribes in Canada, in British Columbia, that each represented their own negotiating body as to whether they wanted the pipeline to cross their territorial lands. So they, too, have political issues that have to be dealt with indigenous people who have a special tie to the land. So another factor that has to be thought about in Canada.
Oh, fascinating. Thank you very much. That is another area of rich investigation, or place where the student could really get into some unique areas of law and explore the authority of indigenous peoples in regards to that issue.
Yes.
Well, Steve, let's go back to this cost issue and kind of the economic stimulus package that is the energy boom. We're talking about these energy companies needing, if my memory serves me right from a moment ago, $600 billion a year. Is that right?
$300 billion a year that they plan to spend to expand their U.S. North American properties, correct?
So the energy companies that we're talking about to be able to fuel the oil, the energy boom, are going to need $300 billion a year.
Yes.
And where's that money coming from?
Well, it's coming from cash flow, from the earnings that they have from their existing businesses. That's one. It can come from selling equity, so they can raise capital by selling new stock in the company. And then certainly it is coming from the debt markets, from both the bank and bond markets. And since what my job is to help energy companies issue long-term debt in the public debt markets here in the U.S., we have estimated that they will take about $110 billion or about 11% of the total $1 trillion that's issued in the U.S. public debt markets each year. And $110 billion will go into energy development and energy refinancing.
Well, so 10% of all of the debt financing in this coming year is going to be energy.
10 or 11%, that's correct. And that number could very well grow a percentage point or two.
Wow. So which one of these capital markets are doing most of the financing for the energy boom?
Well, it's mostly the investment grade market. And what the investment grade market is it's defined by the rating agencies, Moody's, S&P, and Fitch. And they designate that a BBB minus or better up to a AAA rating is investment grade. Below BBB minus into the BB category and down to CCC category is defined as high yield debt or junk bonds. And I would say that the ratio of total capital in the energy space is probably 3-to-1 at least. So if companies are expected to tap the U.S. investment grade bond market for about $110 billion, you're probably looking at about $32 or $35 billion coming out of the high yield or junk market. And then on top of that, you have bank commitments to each of these companies. Many of them are like a credit card that doesn't get used too often, but sometimes companies borrow from their bank facilities, and that is billions of dollars more.
Wow. Wow. So how about the government? Is the government investing money in the energy boom?
Not really, because the government runs at a deficit. They don't have the money to invest in the energy boom. But of course, there's been significant news stories about the government trying to encourage alternative energy and making investments in Solyndra that didn't go too well. But those get blown way out of proportion because we all understand what the government is doing. The government is saying, we've got these wonderful resources of oil and gas, but wouldn't it be nice if we had yet further resources that were renewable? Wind, solar, certainly hydro has been around for a long time. And so to the government's credit, we all understand that that makes a great deal of sense to begin to develop those alternative energy resources as well as we can.
Okay, so the U.S. government's not really a player in these capital markets, and there are a lot of U.S. banks that are. Are there foreign investors involved in the U.S. Energy boom?
Yes. When you consider this year alone, foreign companies come to the U.S. debt markets and seek to borrow mainly from the U.S. investors that we have here. And so just this past month alone, Total, the French oil company, has issued bonds. BP has issued bonds. Pemex has issued bonds, all of them multi-billion dollar issuances.
Wow. And so all of these foreign companies are coming here and investing heavily in energy development in the oil boom in the U.S.?
Well, I just want to be clear. They're coming here raising money, so it's the United States is a source of capital. Hmm. Sometimes they take that capital to all parts of the world. They're also investing. It should be interesting to note that the in 2012, the company that had the greatest investment in the United States, including all the U.S. companies, was BHP Billiton, based in Australia. They invested more in the United States than any other company.
Why? Do you know?
Well, they're looking to develop their unconventional resources, just like every other company. So they're looking to develop gas and oil.
Well, so let's get really specific about some of these financing issues. How do the companies access the capital markets, the debt market and the equity market?
Well, they can access the market a few different ways. One, if they're seen as a fairly good credit where their cash flows are established, they can borrow debt on an unsecured basis. And they can do that in the bank and the public debt and the private placement market. They can raise equity both publicly and privately. If they're seen as a company that's more of a startup, where the establishment of cash flow and profits is just not established yet, and they don't have the track record, they're too small, oftentimes they have to raise debt capital on a secured basis. So they pledge their assets, and based upon how much oil and gas they have in the ground, they can borrow a percentage of that. So they can do secured bank financing, but typically a secured borrower is unlikely to have as significant access to the unsecured public debt markets. And then, of course, they can raise equity. They can sell public debt. They can sell public public equity or private equity. So there are always a large pool of investors, both strategic players and financial investors, who have an interest in buying into this huge upside potential that exists here.
So let's take one of our master students someday, a few years from now, they're working at one of these companies, and they're looking at some of these contracts. How can they tell what, you know, how much of debt and how much of equity, that mix between them, makes sense when they're looking at their company and the agreements their company is making?
Well, they would start at an analysis of the financial statements. Obviously, anybody who's borrowing large amounts of money, that's a public company certainly, has GAAP audited financial statements, and they would look at the balance sheet and see how much debt compared to equity. They would look at the income statement and look at the operating cash flow, look at the EBITDA, which is earnings before interest and taxes, depreciation, amortization. That's the standard measure for cash flow. And so they could borrow typically about 3 to 4 times cash flow or 3 to 4 times EBITDA before they start to run into some heartburn from creditors. That doesn't sound like a huge leverage multiple. Before the financial crisis of 2008, high-yield companies were borrowing 5, 6, 7 times leverage of cash flow. But banks have gotten more conservative. Investors have gotten more conservative. And I will say that the stronger energy companies actually maintain tremendously strong balance sheets, and their leverage is only 1 to 2 times leverage of cash flow. So it's usually a measure of how much debt to how much cash flow the company produces each year.
Well, okay. So all of these transactions, they don't just happen overnight, do they?
Some of them practically do. It's amazing how fast we can bring a seasoned issuer to the public bond markets. And I've literally gotten calls from some large energy companies who say in the next 36 hours we'd like to be in the bond market. So what we do is we use the documentation from the last deal, and we update it for the new financials. Obviously, we drop in the latest financial statistics. We update it for any sort of text changes, but basically you're looking at documentation that is fairly standard, that the company is familiar with, that the auditors are familiar with at the company, that both underwriting counsel and legal counsel for the issuer are familiar with, and they produce a prospectus that allows us to go into the bond market to sell these bonds publicly to investors, and they too see a prospectus that looks awfully similar to the one that they bought 6 months or a year ago. So we're able to access the debt market for our clients very quickly. Bank deals take a bit longer because the credit approvals at most banks take at least 2 weeks to get finalized and approved. But all in all, when you're raising large amounts of capital, 2 weeks doesn't sound like a lot of time, and certainly a matter of days doesn't sound like a lot of time for the bond market.
Yeah, so it's a lot shorter period of time than it took for me to close on my house, as I remember.
that's because the banks have been burned terribly in the mortgage industry, and the rate of default in the energy sector for investment grade companies is almost zero, and the rate of default for energy companies in the high yield market is only about 2%. So it's a pretty strong group of borrowers.
Well, now you said a word a minute ago that piqued my attention as a lawyer. You used the word documentation. And I felt good to hear a familiar word. And I was thinking about our master's students again, and I'm thinking about them when they're off in their jobs. Maybe some of them are working on the transactional side. You know, what sort of documentation should they be seeing, for instance, when there's a bond deal? What goes into a bond package?
Well, certainly the each company needs to have an indenture, which is basically the set of rules that it will borrow money, or the set of rules that it will issue equity. And so these indentures don't get updated too often. It's not uncommon for us to be working with an indenture that's well over 10 years old. They'll be updated as needed. But what does get updated will be the drafting of a new prospectus, the underwriting agreement among the different firms that are underwriting the bonds, because usually these bond deals are done on a multi-handed basis, and we've got to have rules of the road to establish how each of the firms will be operating. You'll see comfort letters from the accountants. These are basically opinions or affirmations from the accountants saying the financial numbers that we helped to prepare that you're looking at making your credit decision on are good, and we're very comfortable with them, and so thus the name comfort letters. And then, of course, you have legal opinions. So the issuing company's counsel will look at the articles of incorporation, they'll look at the corporate charter. If it's an MLP, they'll look at the partnership agreement. They'll look at board of director resolutions and borrowing resolutions. Make sure that the treasurer can sign for $1 billion of bonds, or maybe it's only the CFO who can do that.
Okay.
Well, Steve, I have a follow-up question. You mentioned the rules of the road for the bond deal. Are there any, especially in relation to unconventional resources, any debate or issues that surround what the rules of the road have been for these bond issuances that may be different in the future, or anyone discussing any reforms at the – and I ask the question thinking in terms of what students might have interest in if they're interested in bond deals and such for financing?
It's a great question. When you think about a bond deal, it can live for 30 years. Typically, that's about as long as they go. And given the changes in technologies and the potential changes in environmental law or the potential environmental issues that could come up over the next 30 years related to any of these processes, you would think that there would be an out for the companies from a financial perspective, but no, they're still on the hook. If somebody comes along and says you can't exploit the oil and gas resources that you have in the Marcellus Basin in New York and Pennsylvania, and a company suffers financially, they're still obligated to make all the debt payments under their loans and bonds.
Wow. That's something I had never contemplated, but I can see how that would be problematic for the risk at times, and especially in a changing environment.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really what business that's part of the analysis that goes into how to price these bonds, because when bond investors express an interest in investing in a bond offering, they consider the spread over treasuries, which is the risk premium for that particular company, and they very much are concerned as to whether the company is offshore or onshore with their resources, whether they're developing assets in Western Africa or West Texas. So all of that goes into the analysis to assess what the right price is for their risk.
I think for the students, one thing I would ask you to think about, last week we had Governor Walters who mentioned stability as being an important part of developing energy infrastructure, and I think this is the same type of issue, the concern over long-term stability as you're making these large investments into developing resources is something that companies obviously have to deal with. So I think looking at the legal issues from a stability standpoint, it might be something that would be interesting for you to focus thesis your thesis papers on.
Yeah, it was really fun, Steve.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more, because when companies are making the decisions to exploit a basin or build a pipeline, they're expecting that those assets are going to be good for 30 to 50 years. And if there's a change in the rules of the road or the regulations or how governments or laws impact them in various locations, that has a huge impact on their analysis.
Wow. Well, let's talk about some of the players in the financial markets relating to energy. Who are the primary financial underwriters these days?
Well, the largest energy bank in the country, I'm proud to say, is Wells Fargo. We're number one by loan commitments to the energy industry, and followed by most of the other large banks, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley.
Well, congratulations.
We also have some
Steven.
Large foreign players. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, we like to do our part to help the energy sector. But then you've also got banks like Credit Suisse, UBS, Royal Bank of Canada, who play typically at a second-tier level, but they're very interested in supporting projects here in the U.S.
Hmm. Now, is there a difference between a financial underwriter and a bond underwriter?
No, I'm throwing these terms around. Sorry for being flippant, but the bond underwriters will underwrite the risks associated with the debt, and they'll do their due diligence on the company, and they'll do it for the benefit of the bond investors. But then banks do their own underwriting for when they commit to a bank loan. So you can have bank underwriters, bond underwriters, and of course if there's an equity offering, you have equity underwriters, and they are the same typically financial institutions that will work on that equity deal.
Okay, and so what do these underwriters do?
Well, initially and foundationally, they assess the credit risk of the company. So what the company is asking for in terms of dollar amount, or maybe they're doing a big acquisition or a big capital expenditure plan, can they afford it? Does it make financial sense? And would we lend into it is basically our standard. If we wouldn't lend into it, we're not going to underwrite the bonds. But then we do a set of due diligence, which works in conjunction with our legal teams. So we'll have pages of questions asking for updates on every facet of the business. And then there are always underwriters' counsel and issuers' counsel for a bond deal will always get off separately and go through the they'll have a data room where they'll go through the documentation of a company, and they'll look into such things of sensitive areas such as the environmental changes that have taken place, or maybe there's a new investigation from the SEC, or maybe the New York Stock Exchange has sent them a letter investigating something. So there are numerous areas of risk that those underwriters are checking into so that they're not surprised and so that their investors know everything they can possibly know about that company and their situation to make a good credit decision and a good investment decision.
So what's the relationship between underwriters, which we've just talked about, and we hear about these bond rating agencies or rating agencies in general? What's the relationship between underwriters and rating agencies?
Well, they should be independent, and they are. The rating agencies make their own credit assessment of the companies that issue bonds. And oftentimes they take unusual or contrary views to how the market would see them, how the banks would see them, how the bond underwriters would see them, and certainly how the companies see themselves. And they, I see more often than not a great deal of financial credit analysis that is quite independent from external influences. And, of course, they certainly got blamed heavily during the 2008 era when they made rating decisions on mortgage-backed securities that didn't turn out to be anywhere near the appropriate risk levels. But by and large, Moody's, S&P, and Fitch are the three primary U.S. rating agencies, and in order to sell bonds, you need two out of the three, and they're typically Moody's and S&P.
Okay. So we've kind of set the stage here, and to kind of bring the discussion home, I wanted to really ask you some specific questions about executing a bond deal and what that looks like. Particularly, I wanted to ask you, what happens in the bond market, and how do bonds get sold and priced? I mean, how does that action actually occur? Sorry.
Right. Okay. Once the documentation is done and we're ready to enter the market, we actually caucus the underwriters who are leading the deal, the company who will be issuing the bonds, and the legal counsel for both the issuer and the underwriters will gather on the phone before the markets open and determine whether it appears that it'll be a positive day in the markets. If there's some huge negative news that's coming out in a part of the world that may not affect the bond market, it could still cause investors to want to price a bond deal high or put a high coupon on a transaction just because of the overall risk feeling that it's going up. So in other words, we look for a good time to enter the market. Most days are good. And then we announce the deal into the market, typically about 9 o'clock in the morning. And at that point, once the deal is announced, our sales force, our bond salesmen, are educating investors. They're on the phone. We have over 100 bond salespeople, and they'll be reaching out to hundreds of investors. And simultaneously, the other underwriters who are leading the deal, their sales forces will be doing the same thing. They'll be receiving interest from those bond investors in the way of orders, and those basically the results of the auction that is then taking place in the bond market. We can formulate what the right price for the bond is, and the price for the bonds is typically set at a spread over U.S. Treasuries, seen as the risk-free rate in theory. And so the 10-year Treasury is about 2.8% today, and so if a company wanted to issue a 10-year bond, they would price, if it's a good BBB company, they'd probably price it at about 125 basis points or 1.25% over Treasuries, and so that bond would have a coupon of around 4% for 10 years.
Wow.
All that takes place in a matter of hours. And so we're typically doing our allocations to investors by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the client knows how his deal stands at that time. And so selling a multi-billion dollar bond deal literally gets done before mid-afternoon.
And it started that morning.
Huh. And it started that morning.
Wow.
That's impressive.
Yes.
Well, that... Who are these investors? Who buys these bonds like this?
Well, it's mainly institutional buyers, money managers, pension funds, insurance companies. So names that you're all familiar with, money managers like Fidelity, PIMCO, BlackRock. Pension funds, literally state pension funds, union pension funds. Insurance companies invest in these, especially on the long end of the curve. They like long bonds, Prudential, MetLife, Liberty Mutual, Northwestern. So, but literally in a bond deal that is about $1 billion to $2 billion, you'll probably have about 200 investors in the book.
Wow. Are there any private investors that buy in these kinds of markets?
There are, and they invest typically in something known as a private placement. or they can invest in bonds that are specifically structured for retail investors. So Wells Fargo, for example, has a large retail system with over 15,000 stockbrokers. They can call their clients and say, we're selling a retail bond deal specifically set for retail investors, very similar to the institutional deals, but it would allow a retail investor to buy whatever dollar amount they're comfortable with for a company looking to issue into that market. And pretty much the rules of the road are very similar.
So, you know, this makes me wonder, coming back to Uncle Sam, when I put my money in the bank, it's guaranteed against loss. When these investments are made, are they guaranteed by the government?
Oh, no, not at all. This is an investment that carries unsecured and unguaranteed risk. The only source of repayment and the only risk mitigation is the credit quality of the company themselves. So if you make a choice, if you choose a company that falls on hard times or has a tremendous accident, then the investors in the bond market stand to suffer the loss. But think about the tiering of liquidation preference and bankruptcy. If a company goes bankruptcy, the senior debt holders are typically at the top, and they get paid off first with the reserves that are there. And then the equity investors, the stockholders, get paid after all the debt holders have been paid. So if you own stock in an energy company, you stand a much greater risk of loss. Pardon me. Much greater risk of loss than you would if you were a senior debt investor.
Give you a second to recover there.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Just getting over a little cold.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, one last note, and I think you've been awfully kind to us staying so long and talking about all of these things. You know, I think most of what we've been talking about has been this unconventional and other conventional oil boom development in the U.S., but what about alternative energies? Is there financing going into renewable energy these days?
There is, and we're very interested at Wells Fargo to invest in alternative energies. We have a specific group set up in San Francisco just for that purpose. So they invest in new technologies, which are really, when you think about it, new technologies are fairly risky, and that's more like venture capital money that's going in to allow for new technologies to be developed. And certainly our bank is interested in investing in solar and wind farms that tend to be larger projects to have an economic return.
Okay. Well, Steve, I want to really thank you. Rick, do you have any other questions for Steve at this time?
I would just like to, my heartfelt appreciation on behalf of the students, thank you so much for your time, because it's clear you know your stuff. Your knowledge of securities is dizzying, and we are honored that you were part of our speaker series. And I would also like to close by mentioning to the students that it's clear the importance of securities law in energy. I think Steve is certainly brought that home in stark relief. So I do encourage you to think about that as part of what you might focus your thesis on, because as you can tell, there's a lot to know about it, and we were privileged to have Steve, I have no doubt, one of the most knowledgeable person in the country on some of these issues, to be here. So thank you so much.
And well, you're certainly welcome, and I would welcome any questions that come out of this discussion. Jason, you're welcome to pass along my email address to the students.
Well, thanks. you know, for those of you who are candidates in the master's degree program who are with us tonight, this is your chance. If you've got any questions, you can ask for the mic if you'd want, and ask the question verbally, or you can type your question in. You know, Steve's so gracious, I'll make sure to send you his contact information, and I'm sure he'll answer your questions that way. I see that we actually have a question from Corey. And Corey asks, how heavily public perception opinion is considered when analyzing an industry or a company or an activity in regard to financing? You know, for instance, in Colorado, where Corey is, there's a push against hydraulic fracturing in communities, and there's been a lot of talk of leaks and public outrage towards the oil and gas industry. Does that impact the debt analysis and the bond analysis that you undertake in your work?
Well, certainly, yes. We heard about the recent vote in Colorado that's put a moratorium on fracking, at least in some area of Colorado. I don't claim to be the expert on that, but certainly we would take that into consideration and factor that in as a credit risk. But most companies, their assets are so well diversified that even if they had significant assets in Colorado that were impacted by this moratorium, then in all likelihood they would have other assets that would be sufficient to service the debt on bonds or bank deals associated with borrowing. But the point is a good one, and that is if this was a small company concentrated in Colorado, most definitely that would cause a great deal of caution by banks and by bond investors.
I know Victoria is formulating a question as we speak. So thanks, Steve, for that answer. That's a really good one. And Corey says thank you, too. Victoria asks, are there any new construction projects in the midstream sector to move gas from north to south? And if so, do you know what companies they are?
Oh, they're numerous. If you're talking about the north of the United States to the south, you're really looking at most of the larger companies involved, and that would be Kinder Morgan, Enterprise Products. I believe Energy Transfer Partners has some projects. They're working with Enbridge and TransCanada, which are both based in Calgary, with north and south operations. And even though it sounds like the Keystone XL is the only way for TransCanada to bring oil into the United States, that's not the case. TransCanada and Enbridge already have pipelines into the United States, as do many of the others.
You know, Victoria, I know, is on the East Coast. Are there any north-south midstream projects on the East Coast that come to your mind?
What's interesting is the projects on the East Coast in the Northeast are being developed where they're looking to take the resources from the Marcellus in the Northeast and take them to the nearby markets. So oftentimes they will have to develop a fractionation plant or a blending facility, or take them into the refineries on the East Coast, which are primarily around the Philadelphia-Wilmington area. So yes, there are projects, and there is a tremendous amount of investment being made into the Northeast. I would say initially that's being focused on the gathering facilities, because when you think about a new basin, such as Marcellus, it's going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of wells being drilled, and each well needs to be hooked up to a larger system, and so those are called gathering systems, and they will then go into the interstate lines that are already available, and assuming that those won't be sufficient to take on the additional new capacity, new lines are being planned and are being built.
Well, thank you.
One of the problems that...
Go ahead.
I will mention, too, that with all this new oil and gas being developed in the United States, many people are saying that in 2 or 3 years we're going to be flooded with oil in particular, and they're asking for Congress to lift the moratorium on exporting crude oil out of the United States, which we've had for many years. I believe it went into place during the Iranian oil embargo of the Jimmy Carter years. And so that will be an interesting public debate as to whether it's in our best interest to allow crude oil to be exported. But keep in mind, already the byproducts of crude can be exported, such as propane, butane, ethane, and most interesting, refined products such as gasoline and diesel can be exported already. So you could foresee a bottleneck at the refining level if there's a lot of new crude and that can't be exported, but refined products can be exported. So that'll be a very, very interesting debate over the next few years.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think I saw the newspaper article in the business section of the New York Times this morning when I was looking at it, saying exactly what you just said. So Victoria has a few additional questions here. FERC has approved an LNG terminal in Maryland. Do you know of any other such facilities that are being approved elsewhere in the country?
I'm not aware of any other new LNG facilities, but I know that there are export facilities along the Gulf Coast and I believe off the coast of Georgia already in existence to export LNG. And what's kind of interesting is some of these facilities, I believe in particular along the Gulf Coast, were designed as import facilities because we were anticipating, as I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, 5 to 10 years ago, that we'd be running out of oil and natural gas and we'd need to be importing it from other countries. So now what they're doing is they're repurposing and redirecting those facilities to be export facilities because we have this abundance. But the one in Maryland is actually news to me.
Steve, we owe you a debt. You've taught me a bunch of things today, and I'm really appreciative of it and kind of opened my eyes. I cannot believe that your company is able to move these bond deals in a single day like you described. I could just see the army of people working on it.
Well, it's a fun experience. It's always a good day to be in the office to work on a deal and to and sometimes you get jaded about issuing large amounts of debt. But then sometimes you say to yourself, well, that's pretty interesting. We just sold billions of dollars of 30-year bonds that'll be used for good purpose and for good enterprise for a very long period of time, and it's a very satisfying feeling as well to put investors' money to work.
I think from our perspective, that's like leaping tall buildings in a single bound that you're doing on these deals. One thing I would also like to, in my closing, I would like to encourage the students to take up Steve's offer, his gracious offer, in responding to emails. I don't think you need me to tell you how much he knows about these things and how influential he is in regards to securities law. So I would encourage you to take advantage of that. And thank you again, Steve, for your time.
Sure. My pleasure. It was my I enjoyed it and look forward to future questions. And thank you all.
Thank you. Well, we'll sign off here from Tulsa. And all the best to you in your evening there in North Carolina.
Very good. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Good night.